The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good morning. This is Greg Roman on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia with the Middle East Forum Radio Hour. It has been a monumental 2 weeks. A momentous 2 weeks, a tragic 2 weeks, as the United States ebbs and flows during the global coronavirus pandemic. And right now we are broadcasting from our home studios here in the United States, only about 10 minutes away from the WWDB studios themselves, but it's an amazing thing what we can do with technology. And what we can do in terms of being able to still come to you literally from our living room. So if you hear some yelling in the background, or if you hear some noise that otherwise wouldn't be present in our usually silent studio, except for my voice giving you the latest from the Middle East, you can tell that that's just part of normal everyday life. And you don't want to hear me remiss and give you some information in terms of what's just going on here at home, but you heard... You tuned in to hear for an hour about the Middle East, and that's what we hope to give to you today. We'll be joined by Jonathan Speier, the founder of the Middle East Center for Reporting Analysis. I've known Jonathan for about 12 years now. He is the analyst to listen to read, and to actually follow when it comes to everything dealing with Iran, Iraq, Syria, Israel. He has a fascinating background, and I'm really looking forward to a conversation with him. In fact, I believe he's on air right now, and I know that there was a time difference misunderstanding between our producer and Jonathan. The clock's just changed, so I want to see here. Can we bring him on right now? Jonathan, are you with us?
Yes, I am good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, and thank you for joining us today. I know I apologize about the time issue there, but I want to wish you a very happy and healthy Passover, and thank you for joining us on the eve of the holiday.
Most welcome. I'm very happy to be talking to you.
So, just to introduce you, of course, we want to do that before we get into anything else. Dr. Jonathan Speier is a writer, analyst, and journalist focusing on the Levant and Middle East strategic affairs. He's a research fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies, a fellow at the Middle East Forum, and a freelance security analyst and correspondent at IHS Jane's. He's also the executive director of MECRA, the Middle East Center for Reporting and Analysis, and the author of two amazing books. One, Days of the Fall, A Reporter's Journey in the Syria and Iraq Wars, that came out in 2017. And two, The Transforming Fire, The Rise of the Israel-Islamist Conflict, his first book published by Continuum in 2010. Jonathan, you just wrote this amazing article in the Jerusalem Post, which is titled, at least in our website, Assessing the U.S. Strategy in Iraq. During this time of COVID-19, the coronavirus pandemic, the Middle East still churns on, still has all of its problems and all of its items that we still have to fully understand. And there's not any lack of work for Middle East analysts. What's the U.S. plan for Iraq?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the latest indications we have, the latest statements from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, indicate that there is a meeting coming up in the next weeks in which the United States government and the Iraqi government, such as it is, will discuss the issue of future U.S. deployment in Iraq. Now, we've witnessed the redeployment of U.S. forces from three very significant bases inside Iraq in the last couple of weeks, the three bases being Al-Qaim, Q West, and a base called K-1 outside of Kirkuk. So there is a growing sense that President Trump, in line with his clearly stated intentions, intends to draw down the U.S. troop presence inside Iraq. Now, that's just fine. There's no reason, I think many of us would agree, for right now the deployment of large numbers of U.S. conventional forces inside Iraq. But the question is, what will be the U.S. strategy going down the road. And in this issue, there are two points to be made. Firstly, the ISIS threat has not disappeared. ISIS is still out there in the remote mountains and dusty villages of Sunni central Iraq. And more importantly, I would say right now, the Iranian challenge, the Iranian effort to essentially absorb Iraq in the same way that Iran has absorbed Lebanon in recent years, that project is very much on. And the question is, how is the U.S. going to resist that? Or indeed, is the U.S. going to attempt to resist that? I think, of course, we probably agree the U.S. and the West should resist it. Iranian advance across the region is a danger to Middle East security and maybe to global security too. The question is how to do that. And all I was trying to say, and to put it very briefly, I don't want to go on, in that article in the Post, was to say what's needed is a multifaceted strategy. It's not enough just to do military stuff. It's good that if Hezbollah or other Iran-supported militias hit at U.S. forces in Iraq, that the United States forces should respond. And they have done, and they can, and I hope they continue to do so. But military activity itself is not enough. There needs to be a coordinated strategy involving the intelligence level, the political level, crucially, the economic level, and the military level. And we need to think about how those various aspects can be coordinated into a single strategy. Just a final point to say, the Iranians do this stuff, this multi-level stuff, extremely well. My view is that's the root of their success in a number of contexts in the region, and we need to be thinking about how we can do it in an effective way to counter them.
And is this the way in which we should adopt this strategy just in Iraq? There are other Iranian projects, extraterritorial projects throughout the rest of the Middle East. Iraq is where the U.S. has its mainstay of forces. I mean, yes, there's deployments throughout the Gulf and Saudi Arabia to a certain extent, but we also have Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen to worry about. If we put more pressure on Iraq and respond to Shia aggression there, how will the Iranians potentially react out or maybe, you know, kick or react to doubling down there in these other areas where they have proxy forces?
Well, yeah, so it's a good question. My point is that this is not, of course, only or even solely an American mission. That is to say, it must also be a mission undertaken by Iran's other Middle Eastern enemies, that is to say, America's other Middle Eastern allies. And that, of course, would include Israel, would include Saudi Arabia. It ought to also include United Arab Emirates. It will include the various American Kurdish allies in Iraq and in Syria. And it needs to be a full court, you know, strategic push. Now, my view is that in the Iraqi context, the Americans have a very central role to play because, after all, you know, they've been a key player inside Iraq since 2003. They were the force that took down the Saddam Hussein regime. But if we broaden the map, we broaden the lens, so to speak, you know, in Syria, I would say that Israel had a key role to play in holding down Iranian ambitions. And I note that, you know, quietly and without a great deal of fanfare, there is an effective military effort underway by Israel in Syria to try to hold back and hold down and turn back the Iranian effort in that country. And it involves the intelligence level and it involves the use of Israeli air power. And we saw just over a week ago the latest Israeli quite large scale air attack on an airfield called Sheirat, and we're seeing this on a more or less weekly basis. So the point is that you're quite right. The Iranian project for regional domination has a number of different arms to it, so to speak, and there needs to be a coordinated response, not only involving the United States forces, but involving Israeli forces too. I would say also involving the Saudis and their allies in terms of maybe financial efforts, military effort. Well, they've been doing their best in Yemen without, I would say, achieving an unqualified success there, but that's certainly an important aspect to it too. Finally, with regard to Lebanon, my own view, frankly, is that Lebanon is the country where the Iranian project of hollowing out the country and replacing it with an Iran-dominated power system has advanced most far. And that's, of course, because Lebanon's the country in which Iran's been busy with this stuff for the longest. And that's because Lebanon was the first Arab country to effectively collapse and therefore allow the Iranians to insert themselves and begin this project as long ago as the early 1980s. So in Lebanon, I would say, frankly, it's kind of done. I mean, if you look inside Lebanon and you try and think of who would be the forces that the West or Israel or others, the Saudis or whoever, would use to support against Hezbollah and against the pro-Iranian system, they are so weak and so divided that my own view, at least, is that Lebanon should be regarded today as an effectively Hezbollah-dominated state, and that we should relate to it in that way. We should kind of relate to Lebanon the way we relate to Iran. That's to say, we're not happy that the regime exists there in the way that it does, but it does. It's the dominant force, and we have to relate to it in that way. So Lebanon, I would say, is kind of done. It needs to be looked at in that way. These other countries, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, very much still in play.
So would you agree with the statement, or maybe give your opinion on the statement, Lebanon will stay the course of being an Iranian satellite until we're able to deal with the Iranian regime itself? I mean, there's no hope for this satellite project. You know, Hezbollah has basically taken over, like you said, the political, military, mm-hmm. economic, all the intelligence apparatus of the state itself. Mm-hmm. And we can't disconnect Lebanon until we, you know, reinvent Iran. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. I very much endorse that, because we've seen over the last decade and a half now, quite comprehensive and major efforts made inside Lebanon, supported by the West, by the second Bush administration, supported by Saudi Arabia, to construct or to support and help along a Sunni-led anti-Iranian political force within Lebanon. This was the March 14th movement, if people remember, of Saad Hariri, of the Hariris and others. Now, we saw in 2008 what happened, which was that Hezbollah and the Iranian-led system challenged that effort, the Saudi-supported project, using force. They basically said, in 2008, in May and June of 2008, Hezbollah and Amal basically took over West Beirut, and they said, okay, we're the guys with the guns here. What have you got to challenge us with? And it became rapidly very clear that the March 14th movement had nothing to challenge the Iranian system with when it came to the use of cold brute force, which at the end of the day, power goes out of the barrel of a gun, ultimately, certainly in our region, certainly in Lebanon. And Hezbollah established the fact in 2008 that the pro-West and pro-Saudi forces didn't have anything to compete on that level with. And pretty much since that show or test of force, I would say it's been a done deal. Following that, Hezbollah has continued to march through the institutions, through the intelligence services, through the economic institutions, through the political institutions, the parliament, the cabinet, and also, I would say, increasingly the military, and today dominates that situation. So yes, that will only change if and when, which I think will happen eventually, the Islamist regime in Tehran itself either falls or suffers a major setback and is forced to withdraw from the furthest reaches of its empire, so to speak, which Lebanon currently includes Lebanon and the Mediterranean coast there.
So taking that as a backdrop for the first, I think, really successful Iranian political transformation in the region, maybe since the revolution in 1979-1980, let's refocus on Iraq and Adnan Zorfi, the prime minister designate for the Iraqi government. Now, he's only come in the last few weeks. I think his mandate's 28 days, 30 days. I'm not familiar with the Iraqi parliamentary system. I don't think he has a government yet. But what can the U.S. do, not just talking about the military efforts like we spoke about earlier at the beginning of the interview, but what can the U.S. do, or what can American allies do to bolster Zorfi's potential for riding the wave of, as you say in the article, the now dispersed youthful Shia demonstrators who chanted en masse against the Iran system at great personal risk for 6 months, all form elements of any strategy intended to take on the Iranian system in the country. What does Zorfi have to do to push back against Iran, and what can the U.S. allies and the U.S. itself do to help him?
Well, first of all, we should note that Adnan Zorfi's star in the Iraqi context, so to speak, which rose very rapidly in recent weeks, appears to now maybe be falling, because there is now another candidate. It's not clear if the Prime Minister designate will, in fact, succeed in forming a government. And he has, I think, until the 14th of April, if I'm not mistaken, to do so. It looks increasingly likely that he will not succeed in doing so, and that there will, in fact, be another candidate who ends up, or let's say, who, I don't want to predict anything in Iraqi terms, let's say who becomes the next Prime Minister designate, right? Which is a man called Mustafa Kazemi, who is currently the head of Iraqi Internal Intelligence Service.
Oh, wow.
Now, here's the thing. Here's the interesting thing. As of now, Kazemi has received the support of all of the Shia parties who opposed Zulfi, and today he also received the support of the main Sunni Arab force in the parliament, which indicates that, you know, the politics is beginning to coalesce more around his candidacy than that of Adnan al-Zulfi. But here's the interesting thing. In many ways, the political complexion, so to speak, of both men, that is to say that they are associated with the anti-Iranian element in Iraqi politics and are seen as people who've collaborated closely with the United States in Iraq. You know, that political complexion is common to both men. Zulfi was seen that way. Kazemi is seen that way too, which is why in the past the Shia elements were seen as very much opposed to him. And now they seem to have changed their tune. So it's not quite clear what's going on, except I think we need to add to the mix a very important additional factor. And this, I think, is something crucial to be borne in mind. As you're probably aware, Ismail Ghani, the General Ismail Ghani, the replacement of Qasem Soleimani at the head of Iran's Quds Force of Revolutionary Guards Corps, conducted his first visit to Iraq at the end of March, in the last days of March, March 30th and 31st. I've spoken to a number of my Iraqi contacts, and I've read regional media on this, and it's beginning to become apparent that this was a disastrously unsuccessful visit, that Ghani did not manage to meet with Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the most influential Shia cleric in the country, refused to meet with him. Muqtada Sadr, the also very influential Shia Islamic political and religious leader in Iraq, refused to meet with him. And the people that he did meet with were not in any way inclined towards obeying his directives. So there's very much a strong sense that Ismail Ghani, as was predicted, by the way, and I think you probably remember this, by many analysts when he was appointed, Ismail Ghani, a non-Arabic speaker, a man with no real professional experience in the Arab world. He conducted most of his professional career relating to Afghanistan, also important to Iran, but a very, very different environment. Ismail Ghani is simply not succeeding in replicating the power and influence wielded by the late Major General Qasem Soleimani in the Iraqi context. And it's really interesting to consider why that might be and to remember that Qasem Soleimani was not simply a military leader. He was a military leader. He was a political and diplomatic force too. And as I know that you know well, Greg, you know, political and diplomatic power and influence is kind of less measurable than military power. You can't just pass that on from one person to another. That's something that's built up over time through personal networks, through personal connections and relationships. And it's becoming very clear that Ismail Ghani just doesn't have that kind of clout and that charisma and that influence that Qasem Soleimani had. Add to that picture the death of the late Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, in many ways Iran's most powerful and influential Iraqi figure on the ground in Iraq. And he died, of course, in the same drone strike that killed Soleimani on January 3rd. His replacement, too, I'm hearing from Iraqi friends and contacts, a guy called Abu Fadak al-Muhammadawi, is in no way as influential as he was. His authority is also not accepted by all of the pro-Iranian or Iran-associated militias inside Iraq, which means that what we're getting a sense of is that the pro-Iranian camp is in a mess right now inside Iraq, and it's a good time, an opportune time, to push forward. How does America or how do the Western allies do that? As I said in the article, there's a whole bunch of allies and potential allies for the West inside Iraq. That includes, of course, the Kurds, both Shia demonstrators, as you mentioned, many of the Sunni Arab forces inside Iraq, the secular forces, also the party of former Prime Minister Alawi and others. So it's time to start to get involved in coordinating those forces, first and foremost, to ensure that if it isn't Zulfi, then it should be Kadhimi, that it should be a non-Iran-associated prime minister inside Iraq, so they can then start to try to push back within the political system against the pro-Iranian forces. And parallel to that, of course, military resistance against their ongoing Shia militia insurgency. And parallel to that, once the coronavirus, as we hope very soon, you know, will leave us alone, then it'll be time to start to get those Shia demonstrators back onto the streets with their demands against that corrupt Iran-led system. Bottom line is there's a growing sense that also among significant elements of the Shia in Iraq, they're just a little bit tired of the Iranians. The Iranians aren't bringing them anything. They're not bringing them jobs. They're not bringing them housing. They're not bringing them prosperity. Just empty slogans and more military activity. So there's plenty to be built on in that context, I would say.
So 17 years, we're past 17 years now since the Iraq, I don't want to say conflict, but our American history with Iraq started. It seems as if though Iraq is finally becoming Iraqi rather than an American satellite or an Iranian satellite. I mean, there's maybe this inkling of hope that they're starting a generation later to have the genesis of what it is to reform their own identity.
That's a really fascinating point. Yeah, I think that's probably right. And that's why I would say that, you know, and stress again, when it's wrong for people to sort of put it into dichotomous of form and say, oh, well, you know, if the Americans are pulling out their 5,200, you know, service members in Iraq or a large number of them, that means that America's withdrawing from Iraq and withdrawing from influence in Iraq. That's not true. You don't have to have large numbers of conventional forces on the ground in order to wield influence. And arguably, because, you know, there's nothing that the Iranian-led element would like more than to portray the Americans in Iraq as an occupying force, arguably the presence of those forces is not even really conducive to the U.S. and Western interests. So it may well be the case that, as you interestingly put it, as Iraq moves into becoming, you know, a new system of its own now, not only dominated by Iran or dominated by America, it will be conducive to the American interest to have a much lighter footprint in the country, but a much more directed and subtle and smart footprint than just having, you know, soldiers in large bases that can sometimes end up being just targets for this or that Shia militia.
And I'd like to hear for just a minute or two, Jonathan. I understand you're in Israel right now. There's this stay-at-home order in place. We're about to get to a Passover quarantine. It's as if though a pestilence is going through the land. We have to stay at home and mark our doorposts. What's it like?
Well, I would say that by and large, you know, people are responding to it very well. Israel is a country which is used to crisis. Has its own kind of ability to slip into or to sort of go into a situation of crisis management in which most people know how to respond and how to operate. I would say there's a large degree of social solidarity here. I know that you lived here for a number of years and you know the society well. You know, people here feel close to one another, so it's quite easy for Netanyahu or for the government to use the kind of terms that he did when he said, look, you know, maybe younger people aren't so much at risk from this, but our grandparents built this country for us, so let's take care of our grandparents. And if that means being in a lockdown, if that means, you know, making sure we're not just wandering around and so on, then let's do that. I'd say Israelis have responded pretty well to that. I would say there is a significant, unfortunately, exception to that general picture, or at least, or maybe two exceptions. One, unfortunately, is the Israeli Arab population, which I'd say has responded for various reasons with less, let's say, discipline and less solidarity than we might have hoped. And secondly, unfortunately, the ultra-Orthodox population also has been deeply reluctant to go along with some of the directives that have been given by the government. And as a result, predictably, you know, a massive percentage, I think something like 50 or 60% of Israeli coronavirus cases are coming from the ultra-Orthodox community because they just ignored the directives a few weeks ago, carried on congregating in public, carried on hanging out in each other's houses or in the synagogues and or in the yeshivas. And as a result, even though that has now largely stopped, as a result, the greater number of cases have been found in that community. So Israel is a complex society. In some ways, Israel is a divided society. That's to say, the core population of Israel, I would say, is not divided. It's pretty much united. But there are these communities more on the periphery that are not part of that broader pattern of behavior. And that's where we're seeing a number of the problems coming in. Listen, of course, everybody hopes this can be lifted absolutely as soon as possible. There are indications that the curve of new cases is slowing down. The number of cases are now doubling, you know, over a longer period of time than was the case just a couple of weeks ago. So we hope very much we can get back to normal as quick as possible. But I think there is a high awareness here that this is a real challenge. It's not something made up. And that therefore, you know, we need to mobilize as a society in order to take on this this challenge.
Jonathan Speier, fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies, the Middle East Forum, and the executive director of the Middle East Center for Reporting and Analysis. Thank you for joining us this morning, your evening, your time, and have a very happy Passover. Chag Sameach.
Thank you very much, Greg. Chag Sameach to you and to the listeners, too.
Thank you. After these messages, the MEF Insider.